exercises, but it didn't sound good at all. Not at all. I turned to Victor. Jack shit? Do you think he wants the prose portal badly enough to go to war with Wales?
Who knows what power the Goliath Corporation wields? They might not be behind this at all. Could be coincidence or just saber-rattling. But in any event, I don't think we can ignore it.
Then we need to steal a march. Any ideas?
What did Muller say again?
Asked Finisterre. I sat down. He screamed, "He's at Penderyn, nothing else."
"Nothing else?" asked Bowden.
"No. When Shit asked him which Penderyn he meant, as there must be hundreds, Muller told him to guess." Bowden spoke up.
"What were his precise words?"
"He said guess, then repeated it, but it turned into a yell. He was in grave pain at the time. The conversation was recorded, but there is about as much chance as getting hold of that as..."
"Maybe he meant something else."
"Like what, Bowden?"
"I really only speak tourist Welsh, but Gwesty means hotel."
"Oh my God," said Victor.
"Victor?"
I queried, but he was busy rummaging in a large pile of maps we had accumulated. Each of them had a Penderyn of some sort marked on it. He spread a large street plan of Merthyr Tydfil out on the table and pointed at a place just between the Palace of Justice and Government House. We craned to see where his finger was pointing, but the location was unmarked.
"The Penderyn Hotel," announced Victor grimly. "I spent my honeymoon there. Once the equal of the Adelphi or Raffles, it's been empty since the 60s. If I wanted a safe haven..."
"He's there," I announced, looking at the map of the Welsh capital city uneasily. "That's where we'll find him."
"And how do you suppose we'll manage to enter Wales undetected, make our way into a heavily guarded area, snatch Mycroft and the manuscript, and get out in one piece?" asked Bowden. "It takes a month to even get a visa."
"We'll find a way in," I said slowly.
"You're crazy," said Victor. "Braxton would never allow it."
"That's where you come in."
"Me? Braxton doesn't listen to me."
"I think he's about to start." Chapter 29. Jane Eyre. Jane Eyre was published in 1847 under the pseudonym Currabell, a suitably neuter name that disguised Charlotte Bronte's sex. It was a great success. William Thackeray described the novel as the masterwork of a great genius. Not that the book was without its critics. G.H. Lewes suggested that Charlotte should study Austen's work and correct her shortcomings in the light of that great artist's practice. Charlotte replied that Miss Austen's work was barely, in the light of what she wanted to do, a novel at all. She referred to it as a highly cultivated garden with no open country. The jury is still out. W.H.H.F. Renouf, The Brontes. Hobbs shook his head in the relative unfamiliarity of the corridors of Rochester's home, Thornfield Hall. It was night, and a deathly hush had descended on the house. The corridor was dark, and he fumbled for his torch. A glimmer of orange light stabbed the darkness as he walked slowly along the upstairs hall. Ahead of him, he could see a door which was slightly ajar, through which showed a thin glimmer of candlelight. He paused by the door and peered round the corner. Within, he could see a woman dressed in tatters and with wild, unkempt hair pouring oil from a lantern onto the covers under which Rochester lay asleep. Hobbs got his bearings. He knew that Jane would soon be in to put out the fire, but from which door he had no way of knowing. He turned back into the corridor and nearly leapt out of his skin as he came face to face with a large, florid-looking woman. She smelled strongly of drink, had an aggressive countenance, and glared at him with thinly disguised contempt. They stood staring at each other for some moments, Hobbs wondering what to do, and the woman wavering slightly, her eyes never leaving his. Hobbs panicked, and went for his gun, but with wholly unlikely speed, the woman caught his arm and held it pinched so tightly that it was all he could do to stop yelling out in pain.
"What are you doing here?"
she hissed, one eyebrow twitching.
"Who in Christ's name are you?" asked Hobbs.
She smacked him hard across the face. He staggered before recovering.
"My name is Grace Poole," said Grace Poole. "In service, I might be, but you have no right to utter the Lord's name in vain. I can see by your attire that you do not belong here. What do you want?
I'm with Mr. Mason, he stammered.
Rubbish, she replied, staring at him dangerously.
I want Jane Eyre, he stammered.
So does Mr. Rochester, she replied in a matter-of-fact tone. But he doesn't even kiss her until page 181.
Hobbs glanced inside the room. The madwoman was now dancing around, smiling and cackling as the flames grew higher on Rochester's bed.
If she doesn't arrive soon, there won't be a page 181.
Grace Poole caught his eye again and fixed him with a baleful glare.
She will save him as she has before thousands of times, as she will again thousands of times. It's the way of things here.
Yeah? Replied Hobbs. Well, things just might change.
At that moment, the madwoman rushed out of the room and into Hobbs with her fingernails outstretched. With a maniacal laugh that made his ears pop, she lunged at him and pressed her uncut and ragged nails into both his cheeks. He yelled out in pain as Grace Poole wrestled Mrs. Rochester into a half-Nelson and frog-marched her to the attic. As Grace got to the door, she turned to Hobbs and spoke again.
Just remember, it is the way of things here.
Aren't you going to try and stop me?
Asked Hobbs in a puzzled tone.
I take poor Mrs. Rochester upstairs now, she replied. It is written.
The door closed behind her as a voice shouting, Wake! Wake! Brought Hobbs' attention back to the blazing room. Within, he could see the night-robed Jane throwing a jug of water over the recumbent form of Rochester. Hobbs waited until the fire was out before stepping into the room, drawing his gun as he did so. They both looked up, the Elves of Christendom line dying on Rochester's lips.
Who are you? They asked together. Believe me, you couldn't possibly begin to understand.
Hobbs took Jane by the arm and dragged her back towards the corridor.
Edward, my Edward, implored Jane, her arms outstretched to Rochester. I won't leave you, my love.
Wait a minute, said Hobbs, still backing away. You guys haven't fallen in love yet.
In that you would be mistaken, murmured Rochester, pulling out a percussion pistol from beneath his pillow. I have suspected something like this might happen for some time.
He aimed at Hobbs and fired in a single quick movement. He missed, the large lead ball burying itself in the doorframe. Hobbs fired back a warning shot. Hades had expressly forbidden anyone in the novel to be hurt. Rochester pulled a second pistol after the first and cocked it.
Let her go, he announced, his jaw set, his dark hair falling into his eyes.
Hobbs pulled Jane in front of him.
Don't be a fool, Rochester. If all goes well, Jane will be returned to you forthwith. You won't even know she's gone.
Hobbs backed down the hall towards where the portal was due to open as he spoke. Rochester followed, gun outstretched, his heart heavy as his one and only true love was dragged unceremoniously from the novel to that place, that other place, where he and Jane could never enjoy the life they enjoyed at Thornfield. Hobbs and Jane vanished back through the portal, which closed abruptly after them. Rochester put up his gun and glowered. A few moments later, Hobbs and a very confused Jane Eyre had fallen back through the prose portal and into the dilapidated smoking lounge of the old Penderin Hotel. Acheron stepped forward and helped Jane up. He offered her his coat to warm herself. After Thornfield Hall, the hotel was decidedly draughty.
"Miss Eyre," announced Hades kindly. "My name is Hades, Acheron Hades. You are my respected guest. Please, take a seat and compose yourself."
Edward.
Quite well, my young friend. Come, let me take you to a warmer part of the hotel.
Will I see my Edward again?
Hades smiled.
It rather depends on how valuable people think you are.
Chapter 30. A groundswell of popular feeling. Until Jane Eyre was kidnapped, I don't think anyone, least of all Hades, realised quite how popular she was. It was as if a living national embodiment of England's literary heritage had been torn from the masses. It was the best piece of news we could have hoped for. Bowden Cable, Journal of Alliteratech.
Within 20 seconds of Jane's kidnapping, the first worried member of the public had noticed strange goings-on around the area of page 107 of their deluxe hidebound edition of Jane Eyre. Within 30 minutes, all the lines into the English Museum Library were jammed. Within 2 hours, every Literatech department was besieged by calls from worried Bronte readers. Within 4 hours, the president of the Bronte Federation had seen the Prime Minister. By supper time, the Prime Minister's personal secretary had called the head of Spec Ops. By 9 o'clock, the head of Spec Ops had battered it down the line to a miserable Braxton Hicks. By 10, he had been called personally by the Prime Minister, who asked him what the hell he was going to do about it. He stammered down the line and said something wholly unhelpful. Meanwhile, the news was leaked to the press that Swindon was the centre of the Jane Eyre investigation, and by midnight, the Spec Ops building was encircled by concerned readers, journalists and news network trucks. Braxton was not in a good mood. He had started to chain smoke and locked himself in his office for hours at a time. Not even putting practice managed to soothe his ruffled nerves, and shortly after the Prime Minister's call, he summoned Victor and me for a meeting on the roof, away from the prying eyes of the press, the Goliath representatives, and especially from Jack Shit. "Sir?" said Victor, as we approached Braxton, who was leaning against a smokestack that squeaked as it turned. Hicks was staring out at the lights of Swindon with a detachment that made me worried. The parapet was barely 2 yards away, and for an awful moment I thought perhaps he was going to end it all. "Look at them," he murmured. We both relaxed as we realised that Braxton was on the roof so he could see the public that his department had pledged to help. There were thousands of them, encircling the station behind crowd barriers, silently holding candles and clutching their copies of Jane Eyre, now seriously disrupted, the narrative stopping abruptly halfway down page 107 after a mysterious agent in black enters Rochester's room following the fire. Braxton waved his own copy of Jane Eyre at us.
"You read it, of course?"
"There isn't much to read," Victor replied. "Eyre was written in the first person. As soon as the protagonist has gone, it's anyone's guess as to what happens next. My theory is that Rochester becomes even more broody, packs Adele off to boarding school, and shuts up the house."
Braxton looked at him pointedly.
"That's conjecture, analogy."
"It's what we're best at."
Braxton sighed.
"They want me to bring her back. I don't even know where she is. Before all this happened, did you have any idea how popular Jane Eyre was?"
We looked at the crowd below. "To be truthful, no." Braxton's reserve was all gone. He wiped his brow. His hand was visibly shaking.
"What am I going to do? This is off the record, but Jack Shit takes over in a week if this whole stinking matter hasn't made any favourable headway."
"Shit isn't interested in Jane," I said, following Braxton's gaze over the mass of Bronte fans. "All he wants is the prose portal."
"Tell me about it next. I've got 7 days to obscurity and historical and literary damnation. I know we've all had our differences in the past, but I want to give you the freedom to do what you need to do. And," he added magnanimously, "this is irrespective of cost."
He checked himself and added,
"But having said that, of course, don't just spend money like water, okay?"
He looked at the lights of Swindon again.
"I'm as big a fan of the Brontes as the next man, Victor. What will you have me do?"
"Agree to his terms, whatever they are, keep our movements completely and utterly secret from Goliath, and I need a manuscript."
Braxton narrowed his eyes.
"What sort of manuscript?"
Victor handed him a scrap of paper. Braxton read it and raised his eyebrows.
"I'll get it," he said slowly, "even if I have to steal it myself."
Chapter 31. The People's Republic of Wales. Ironically, without the efficient and violent crushing of the simultaneous Pontypool, Cardiff and Newport risings in 1839, Wales might never have been a republic at all. Under pressure from landowners and a public outcry at the killing of 236 unarmed Welsh men and women, the Chartists managed to push the government to early reform of the parliamentary system. Buoyed by success and well represented in the House, they succeeded in securing Welsh Home Rule following the 8 month Great Strike of 1847. In 1854, under the leadership of John Frost, Wales declared its independence. England, weighed down with troubles in the Crimea and Ireland, saw no good reason to argue with a belligerent and committed Welsh assembly. Trade links were good,
and devolution, coupled with an Anglo-Welsh non-aggression treaty, was passed the following year. From Zephania Jones, Wales.